Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Today, for the first few minutes of this hour, we'll be talking with Carolyn Tuft of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about the child sex abuser that formerly worked for Joyce Meyer Ministries. We'll also get her to recap some of the special report that was recently published in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch at the outset there. We'll take your phone calls after Carolyn departs for a few minutes, and then at 4:30, we're going to round off the rest of Issues Etc., the final hour of the program from 4:30 to 5:30 with Brian Gadawa. We'll get a holiday movie review. He's a Hollywood screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. Carolyn Tuft is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, co-author of a recent series for the Post-Dispatch titled Joyce Meyer Ministries, A Special Report. Carolyn, welcome back.
Thank you.
Carolyn, if you would you recap the series that you did, the special report on Joyce Meyer?
We ran a four-day series. It was a five-month investigation into the workings of the Joyce Meyer Ministries, which is based in Fenton, Missouri, which is right outside of St. Louis. We showed that much of the money is being used to help Joyce Meyer and her family live a pretty comfortable lifestyle. We showed how she was able to raise that money at her conferences by cajoling her participants, the people who come to watch her. And we showed some of her outreach programs, which included the Dream Center in the city of St. Louis.
Now, the Dream Center figures into this other story, but before we get there, what has been the reaction you've received from the public now that you've had the series out there published in the Post-Dispatch for a couple of weeks?
Last week it went over the wire, and so we're getting calls now from around the country. And most people are very supportive of us getting into this subject and are happy that we were able to expose what we were able to expose, and about 30% are saying that they'll continue to give to her ministry despite what we reported.
How did you come across the newest story that was published over the weekend?
On the third day of the series, we wrote about the Dream Center, which is an outreach program. Part of that program entails a pastor who goes out with volunteers from around the region who come into the city, and they go out to minister to the homeless and prostitutes. And that story, which ran with a picture, prompted a juror in a criminal trial to call us and tell us that this pastor, Richard Jones, had been convicted of child molestation at his former church.
So how did the story unfold?
We went and looked up the case down in, was in Cape Girardeau on a change of venue, which is about three counties south of here. The alleged incidents happened at a church in Park Hills, Missouri, which is in a county about two counties south of St. Louis. So we went and looked at the file and found that he had been convicted of 27 counts of child abuse against two teenage boys that he was ministering to at his former church where he headed the youth ministry. He was able to get an overturnment because one of the witnesses was allowed to testify that he had been accused of similar things at an earlier church that he had worked at out of Springfield, Missouri. And then he pled guilty to two of those counts against the two boys, involving the two boys, and served 6 years in prison. Actually, he only served four of the 6 years.
And how did this story eventually come to be connected with the outreach of Joyce Meyer Ministries, the Dream Center?
It was important for a couple of reasons. For the first reason that it was important was that people were sending their teenagers alone, in a group, to the Joyce Meyer Ministries Dream Center in St. Louis to work with this pastor, and they didn't know his past. It also became very evident to us that Joyce Meyer knew about his child sex abuse background and allowed him to work with the children anyway. we found him at his home down on a little road called God's Country Lane, where he lives next door in a pretty nice house next door to the head pastor at the Dream Center. He told us immediately that he had been sent home when Joyce Meyer was told about our investigation into this particular pastor and was ordered not to talk about it. We gave Joyce Meyer Ministries several days to answer a bunch of questions about it, and finally they said that he had left the ministry and that because of our investigation, and that they knew about his background. They put him in that position, but they were assured that he was never alone with these teenagers.
Now, as far as you can tell, what is kind of the standard operating procedure when it comes to people who've been not only accused but convicted of crimes like this, when it comes to any kind of either nonprofit or any kind of organization and contact with either minors or teenage kids?
That's what's most puzzling about this whole thing, is because most organizations, once they have been made aware of such a background, would probably go to great lengths to make sure that they have no interaction with children, especially teenagers, when that is basically the target that he went after. And also, Joyce Meyer Ministry has quite a lengthy application process when they hire people, that includes that they have to divulge their any criminal charges placed against them. It seems to me that what happened in this case was that it was someone who knew the Myers, recommended him for the job, and so it sort of sidestepped all that, and they said, well, we'll forgive him for what he did. It's also pretty interesting because Joyce Meyer's big claim to her followers is that she herself was abused as a child by her father, sexually abused, and the reaction we're getting since that story ran is that some people are now doubting that she really was the victim of childhood sexual abuse, because most victims of sexual abuse would never condone putting a convicted child abuser with teenagers or children.
Just so that we're clear on the timeline here, it is apparent to you, according to your reporting and your investigation, that Joyce Meyer Ministries knew of his accusation, the accusations against him, and of the convictions of the jail time, and he's pleading guilty to two of these counts against him for sexual abuse. They knew of that prior to hiring him.
Yes, they said that in a written statement, that they knew it, and that they felt that he would had turned his life around.
Have there been any new policies enunciated by Joyce Meyer Ministries since the story came out this weekend?
Yes. After we alerted them about the situation, which they already knew about because they said they knew about it, they instituted a new policy that any child molester will not be allowed to work around children anymore.
Finally, Carol, back to the series that you did, the special series that you did with Joyce Meyer Ministries, have either you or your colleague Bill Smith had opportunity to talk with anyone from Joyce Meyer Ministries since the series ran several weeks ago?
Joyce Meyer has denied us a follow-up interview with her and her staff. Instead, she chose to go on Channel 5 and basically try to defend herself. She gave no indication of anything that we had reported incorrectly. She said that her problem was that she feared that people would think that would not trust her with their money any longer. That was her big, basically her big complaint.
So she didn't refute any factual elements of the series?
No, she did not.
All right. Have you discovered, after doing the reporting, any factual errors yourself or any corrections that need to be made from the series?
No, a spokesman went on another radio station, I don't know if it was yours or another radio station, claiming that unlike our story, which we very graciously gave them 10%, which it isn't quite 10%, that they supposedly give to charities, which includes their television broadcasts around the world, which I don't know if you can even include that, but we did include it, that they actually give 91%. However, in an audit that she placed on her internet site, it still is only under 10% that they give to charitable purposes, which includes her international airing of her television program.
Joyce will be appearing sometime mid-January, if I'm not mistaken. I saw a billboard yesterday on the way home somewhere here in St. Louis. Any plans to cover that event here in St. Louis?
I'm sure we will. It's in St. Charles. She's now in Hawaii.
Carolyn Tuft, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
You're very welcome.
Carolyn Tuft is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She co-authored a recent series for the Post-Dispatch titled Joyce Meyer Ministries, a Special Report, and also a story that ran this weekend along with Bill Smith, Child Sex Abuser Quits Meyer Ministry. Now I'd like your questions and your comments for about the next 10-15 minutes. Brian Goodall will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. We'll be talking about holiday movies, getting a bit of a review of the ones he has seen. He'll be applying some of his expertise not only as a screenwriter but also as the author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Movies with Wisdom and Discernment, to several of the movies you may have seen during this holiday season as well. That's at 4:30, but until then, I'd like your questions, your comments, and your reaction to the latest news about Joyce Meyer Ministries. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 now. I've told this story before, and I feel the need to at least outline it one more time again so that you understand at least my perspective on this, my reaction to this. There's been a lot made in the last 2 years over Roman Catholic priests and their sexual abuse and the degree to which the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church permitted these priests to be moved around with full knowledge of accusations against them. And everyone, evangelicals, everyone, rightly condemns this in the Roman Catholic Church and anywhere it is found. And to that end, I have made a point here several times of talking about a predecessor of mine in the parish I served who was accused of some impropriety with a young boy and who was promptly, when the accusation was made, removed by the elders of the church, by the actual members of the church. He was removed from the ministry. He was told to pack his bags and go over against the objections of church officials in my own church body. He was promptly moved to another parish. The other parish was not told about the accusations. When they heard of them, he was removed there. He ended up going up to the Chicago area, sadly enough, again in another parish. Finally went to jail for sexually abusing teenage boys. Wherever this is found, it needs to be condemned. Wherever men are simply moved from one place to another or allowed to have contact with young people, we need to say this cannot exist in the church. Now, here's a question for you. Do you think that a Christian organization should give a convicted sex offender a second chance after their conversion to Christianity? Give me a call in the next 10 minutes, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In some states in the United States, you have to register as a convicted sex offender. When you move into a new community, you have to go to the county seat and you have to register as a convicted sex offender. In some cases, your neighbors have to be informed that you're a convicted sex offender so that they can take whatever appropriate actions they find necessary. It's come from the fact that people say, you know, I didn't know that the fellow who moved down the street from me just got out of prison for molesting little girls or little boys. I would like to have known that. I would like to have known that because I have children. I've wondered before, how is it that the Roman Catholic hierarchy could allow priests accused of sexual abuse to go from parish to parish without informing people? How is it that in my own church body the same thing could take place? Mine is not the story I told was not an isolated incident. It's happened elsewhere, too, and virtually across every denomination. I now enjoy Smyer Ministries. No new accusations made there, but a convicted, an imprisoned, and released sex offender pleaded guilty to two charges after 27 were made, allowed to, at least through neglect or knowledge, have contact with more kids. A deficient view of original sin, perhaps? Somehow we believe that once you're a Christian, you no longer struggle with your past sins or the temptations? What is it? I know it was at work in the story that I told from my own past experience, and that was, well, the prevailing viewpoint was that pedophilia, phoebophilia, whatever you want to call it, was something that could be solved with enough counseling. And so that's all these poor souls really need is just some counseling, and then once they're counseled, they're back on their feet. Well, the recidivism rate of sexual abusers is almost 100%. That is not saying that Christ cannot make a difference in the life of a sexual abuser. We're talking here about wisdom and prudence. Darlene is calling from St. Louis. Darlene, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor. First of all, I want to make the comment that if we were betting people, I would bet you $100 that within their circles, they're saying he got saved, and so this is all over. It's forgiven, it's forgotten, and God delivered him.
Well, it is forgiven and forgotten from God's perspective. We don't want to deny that.
Right.
The question is whether is it wise or prudent to simply hand essentially a former arsonist a pack of matches.
Absolutely not. And but see, they're going to tell their people this is persecution. Second of all, I believe, as you do, that this is forgiven and forgotten by God. But I don't think, you know, you don't put temptation in front of your face. You don't sit there and just encourage that kind of thing. There are plenty of things that he could have done in ministry, in the church, not dealing with children. And that's the way I feel, that if you are saved and want to work within the ministry, that's fine. But you don't go in with kids or whatever the situation. You know what I'm saying.
Darlene, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. So what about the rest of you? What do you think? Why does this happen? I mean, it happened in spades in the Roman Catholic Church in diocese after diocese. And one might argue, and we've had people on for the last 2 years talking about this. I asked the question, how did this happen? And the question is, well, you got to remember the hierarchy of the church is extremely insulated, that there is a certain latitude granted by the state to the Roman Catholic Church. And the same is true of other denominations as well. There's what I mentioned before, that prevailing kind of psychotherapeutic idea from the 60s and 70s that even something like sexual abuse is just a problem that a little time on the couch with the proper shrink and we'll make that go away, lickety-split. No. Or is it a deficient view of original sin? That sin is not such a problem that it continues even by way of temptation to plague the Christian. Joe's calling from his car. Joe, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, I agree 100% that the guy shouldn't be involved in the same ministries. And another perspective that if he is a Christian, then he should be concerned about the reputation of Christ. And he should not even want to be in the potential situation where there could be any kind of even perceived impropriety in the church. You know, a guy that is to the position of education of a pastor, he should be knowledgeable enough to know that, you know, that's just what's the upside to it? Like, all sorts of negatives for a guy that's had that kind of history to go back into that situation, you know, to bring shame to Christ. And as far as the Catholic Church, I think that is despicable, you know, that the whole... I mean, how much time did Paul spend in First Corinthians saying that, you know, a little yeast will leaven the whole lump, and you can't wink at sin, you can't do it.
Joe, thank you very much. Those are excellent thoughts. That's what I was just thinking. Is let's say I'm the sexual offender, and I have come out of that. I've done my time in prison, I paid my debt to society, and and I'm a Christian now. Do I want to be put in that position? Hey, we'd like you to work with the teenagers. I think I would say, just out of wisdom, don't do that. I'll do anything else, but don't ask me to do that, because that's where my temptation, at least at one time, that's where my temptation lay, right? Don't do that. I'll be quite frank with you, folks. There are some things I can't do in the church. I know where my temptations lie. And there's some things I can't do in the church. This is why pastors are smart to leave their doors open when they're counseling female parishioners. They know where their temptations lie. And they realize that their wisdom and prudence is the better part here of proper conduct in the church. And Joe makes an excellent point, and that is to even risk bringing ill repute on Christ himself. It should be avoided. Kathy's calling from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor. I think, too, that a lot of people who are even within the church or even without out of the church might look at the church and say, well, they condemn homosexuality from the pulpit, but then they tolerate it within the church by just kind of ignoring it and not really dealing with it. And maybe they don't really condemn it as much as they say. So I think it's just generally not good. They need to back up what they say.
Kathy, thank you very much. This is what I'm wondering, and this applies to everybody, but I'll use the Joyce Meyer Ministry since it's the one that came up over the weekend. An accountant worked for a big accounting firm. He is accused and convicted and serves time for, say, embezzlement. He embezzled a lot of money from his clients, hundreds of thousands of dollars. He spent his time in prison, paid his debt to society. Would Joyce Meyer Ministries hire him to do the books? Of course not. Would they let him be the treasurer of the organization with the ability to write checks? Move money around from accounts to accounts. Never, ever, ever. They'd say, I know you paid your debt to society, but and yes, you are freely forgiven and all is forgotten by God, but the better part of wisdom will be that we're not going to let you handle our money. So why would they let them, a convicted sex offender, handle their kids or someone else's kids? If a layperson who serves as a treasurer in a congregation is found to have been misusing the funds, chances are, while he, if repentant, can be brought back into the fold of the family and forgiven and restored, as Paul tells us we ought to do with those who repent, chances are he won't be elected treasurer again, nor should he. Not by way of punishment, but by way of wisdom. If we care this much about our offerings and our money and the funds of the ministry, shouldn't we have equal care for the little sheep that are put in under our care? I've said it before and I'll say it again. In the case of the Roman Catholic Church or wherever else this takes place, there are two crimes committed, that of the sexual abuse and the second crime, although the law may not recognize it, the second crime is those who permit it to continue or even allow the situation that would permit it to continue. We'll be right back and talk with Brian Gadawa about holiday movies.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Why did the real St. Nicholas give out gifts? Who was Nicholas? When and where did he live? And why does the real story of the real St. Nicholas tell us more about Christ than about Kris Kringle? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for December is the children's book, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. In this book, the real story of St. Nicholas is beautifully illustrated and simply told. You can order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend by Julie Stiegelmeyer.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Thinking about buying a video game for someone this Christmas? The National Institute on Media and the Family says there are some every family should avoid. This year's MediaWise video game report card notes a dangerous trend toward ultra-violent games. Steve Jordahl reports one in particular has drawn their scorn.
The number one game to avoid this year is Manhunt. In this scene, a man is approached from behind and murdered with a nail gun.
He cannot hide forever!
It's so bad that Institute President Dr. David Walsh has coined a new term to describe it.
If pornographic is the graphic depiction of sexual activity, then I think killographic is the graphic depiction of brutal violence.
Manhunt continues a trend that is popular with young people. The Institute says 87% of 4th through 12th grade boys that play video games play M-rated games.
These games are among the most popular among teenage boys. I think it is what is real disturbing, and a real warning bell should go off for all of us parents concerned about our children.
Only one student in five says his parents had ever prevented him from buying a game because of its rating. Lawyer Jack Thompson is prosecuting several cases where violent video games have contributed to copycat crimes.
This is the most dangerous entertainment medium that man has devised so far in history. I believe this is going to stop, unfortunately, when something at the level of Columbine to the factor of 10 happens.
Until then, it behooves parents to think twice about the video games they allow in their homes. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Other games to avoid, according to the report, roadkill, outlaw volleyball, and backyard wrestling, all rated M. On the positive side, the report recommends SimCity 4, Zelda, The Wind Walker, and Madden 2004. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Research has shown that six qualities build strong families. They include commitment to promoting each other's welfare and happiness, appreciation and affection, positive communication, time together, spiritual well-being, and the ability to cope with stress and crises. Join us next time as we partner with the home in growing healthy families.
Family Shield, Saturday mornings at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. It's the perfect Christmas gift for your young child or grandchild. St. Nicholas is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. The remaining hour from 4:30 to 5:30 here, we're going to be talking with Brian Gadawa, a Hollywood movie review. Tomorrow on the program, gay marriage. Dr. Bob Weiss of Concordia Seminary will join us to give us his thoughts on this. Also, the impact of 50 years of Playboy magazine. Did you realize that Playboy is celebrating its 50th anniversary? Hugh Hefner, the Playboy mansion, the Playboy lifestyle, something born in the early 60s. We're going to be talking with Reed Mercer Schuchart, author of the cover story in Christianity Today, Hugh Hefner's Hollow Victory, on 50 years of Playboy magazine tomorrow on Issues Etc. Brian Gadawa is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He joins us for the remaining hour to do a Hollywood movie review. He's a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. Brian, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. It's good to be here.
Let's begin and jump right in with our review. The biggest box office movie at present is The Last Samurai. Tell us about it.
Well, it's sort of a Dances with Wolves story starring Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise plays a Civil War hero who is basically, because he's been involved in some atrocities against the American Indians, he's really sort of become cynical and given up on life. And he gets the opportunity to go over to Japan by, you know, invited by some Japanese industrialists to try to train the emperor's forces. This is during the Meiji period. And he has to train the forces, the government forces, to fight against the last of the samurai who represent the ancient ways. And the Japanese emperor and the government wants to turn Western and sort of give up their old ancient ways, you know. So Tom Cruise gets over there, gets captured by the samurai, and ends up becoming their prisoner and ends up learning the samurai ways, and then, of course, ends up fighting on their side against the government by the end of the story. So it's an East meets West story where the Westerner is put into the Eastern world and sort of learns a different worldview.
So, you know, by way of character arc, by way of the story that we've talked about before, the element of redemption that is common to all good stories, sounds like you've got a guy who's basically a nasty, hired more or less as a mercenary, who eventually is able to join his enemy and make a change. What's wrong with the movie, Brian?
Well, I think, first of all, I think there's some really good things about the movie. You know, I mean, it's a great opportunity to show and compare, you know, the various East-West worldviews, you know, and I think that's a good thing. And it also shows the modern versus the ancient, you know, the modern worldview versus the ancient, and it attempts to sort of show what's good, what's been lost in terms of honor and nobility from the ancient ways based on the modern ways. The unfortunate thing is it tends to, as most of these movies do, they tend to sort of cast Western view in the worst light and the Eastern view in the best light. And so it's all the Western stuff is the warmongering, profiteering, evil, greedy capitalists, you know, who perform their own mindless atrocities, killing innocent women and children, Indians, and then it tends to show the Eastern viewpoint in mostly positive aspects, you know, like the nobility and the honor of the ways of the samurai. You know, the samurai followed a stringent warrior code. They were very honorable and noble and good warriors, and they fought on behalf of good causes, and they protected their patrons, etc. And so, but what they don't show is all the bad sides of the Eastern culture. For instance, you know, the Eastern worldview tends to elevate the community, the collective, the government, the broad community over the individual. So the individual has no value whatsoever. In other words, there's a famous saying in the Meiji imperial rescript that says that one life weighs less than a feather. And, you know, the Buddhist philosophy believes that we're all like single drops who drop into an ocean of water and dissolve. Our identity has no value. Well, what happens from that is that individuals are cruelly beaten and destroyed if they get out of line from their hierarchy, from the way they've been raised or live. You know, there's a cruelty that goes through Eastern culture that they also didn't show, a cruelty that believes in karma, believes that because people are living out their punishment for past lives, then we're not supposed to help them. See, because if we help them, we're hurting them from living out their just punishment so that they can move on to the next life and climb the ladder of reincarnation. Well, see, what that results in is you don't end up helping people who are suffering. It's a very cruel religious worldview that on the surface you don't recognize that, but they don't show these elements of the Eastern worldview that are also equally, if not more cruel than the Western view. And so what was really sorely lacking in the movie was, I thought, a sort of a balanced approach to showing both the good and the bad of both sides, because there is good and bad in both sides.
On this review, I'm going to ask you to do this with every one of them. I'd like you to rate it on kind of the four-star scale, but I'd also like you to give your level of recommendation on this film. What about The Last Samurai by way of your recommendation, and how would you rate it on the star scale?
Yeah, that's a good separation, because I oftentimes find very good movies, excellent movies, that communicate their worldview well. I just don't necessarily agree with the worldview, and for that reason, I may not recommend it. And Last Samurai is a perfect example of, I consider it a four-star movie. It's not Braveheart. Nothing has come close to Braveheart, but it's close. But I would recommend it with caution. I would recommend it as, you know, watch the movie, but be aware of the prejudice and bias that shows all the bad of the Western side and mostly just the good of the Eastern side, and doesn't have a good balance. And I think that's the purpose of movies is, it, you know, it's okay to watch movies you may not agree with, just like it's okay to talk to people you may not agree with, because you may learn some things from it, but then learn how and in what ways do you disagree. So I would recommend it, but with caution.
And as far as if you were going to employ your critic's hat, one being poor, four being excellent, where would you give it on a star scale?
Oh, yeah, four stars.
Let's talk about Elf. I saw this recently with my kids, and I found it just basically a delightful little diversion with some great holiday music in it. What's the story of this film, Elf?
Yeah, Elf is a great, funny little movie. Basically, Will Ferrell plays a human being who was he was an orphan as a little baby, and through strange coincidence, he ends up at the North Pole in Santa's house, and they don't know where he comes from, so they have to end up raising him as a child, and they raise him to think he's an elf, so that he'll belong. The problem is elves are real small and humans are real big, so when he grows up and is big, you know, there's a real strange oddity going on there, and they finally reveal to him that he's actually human, and his father, he was abandoned, you know, as a baby, and his father didn't even know that he had a child, and he lives in New York. So Will Ferrell sets out to find his father in New York, and he travels from the North Pole down to New York. He still has his goofy little elf suit on because he really, you know, he still considers himself of elven heritage, right? And, of course, then, you know, he finds his father, and his father, played by James Caan, is not at all interested. He's a very selfish man who is not interested in others but in his own power and advancing in his own career and stuff. So it's really a story of redemption for his father as Will Ferrell's innocence and naivete in a cynical world around him. And the cool thing about the movie is that it's, you know, I listened to the producer, Todd I can't say his last name, but I listened to the producer the other night speak in an event, and he basically he says that the theme is innocence wins, and that's what he loves about the movie so well. And that's what I like about it as well, is in this cynical, dark world where most children, you know, lose their innocence way too early in terms of life, this movie shows that innocence can be good, and that's a very unusual theme in modern movies. And it's rated G, and there's no, you know, it's just, there's no sex and violence stuff. It's a great, in that sense, it's a good, wholesome, valued movie.
I think it was almost entirely free of any kind of coarse language, any sexual innuendo. It was a genuinely rated G movie, but it was also fun to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I was laughing my head off the first, you know, half or three quarters of the movie.
An odd casting choice, Ed Asner as Santa Claus.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, Mr. Liberal activist himself. As a matter of fact, unfortunately, at about halfway through the movie, it suddenly struck me and concerned me to the point where I really got angry, and that was, this is a movie about the true spirit of Christmas. And that's even how it's communicated in the film, the true spirit of Christmas. And, of course, nowhere in this entire movie is there any reference whatsoever, not even a vague visual reference to a manger under a tree. There's no reference whatsoever to the true spirit of Christmas, which is Jesus Christ. And unfortunately for me, that's why I wouldn't recommend the movie, because in a way, the worst things, I think, in society are the subversive things. When something's bold and outright complaining against God, you can debate it, you can have issues with it. But when something is portrayed or has good values, but it subversively ignores God, to me that's a worse offense. And particularly on the most important sacred holiday to Christianity, you know, one of the most important, you know, obviously Easter would be another, but, you know, the incarnation of Christ in Bethlehem, you know, and that's what Christmas is really about. And to have a movie about Christmas where nothing at all is referenced to the true meaning, to me, is subversively negative and really an offense, because it's sort of like, I would rather see a movie that fights against God, because at least they're dealing with him. But when you ignore God, you're truly subverting him. And for that reason, I really personally don't recommend the movie, because it's an offense to my religious beliefs in a way that other movies aren't.
Brian Gadawa is our guest, a screenwriter in Southern California. A holiday movie review during this hour. If you've seen something recently on the big screen or on video and would like to get the reaction of our expert guest here, give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. As usual, when Brian is on the line, the best callers will receive Brian's book, Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Let's talk about The Missing. It is a film I have not seen, although, since it has Tommy Lee Jones in it, I have a plan to watch it on video because he's one of my favorites. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, The Missing is a really interesting movie. It's sort of a remake of an old movie with John Wayne in it called The Searchers, and it's basically about a woman in the Western frontier days, played by Cate Blanchett, and she's brilliant in the film, by the way. But anyway, her daughter is kidnapped by some rogue Indians. And in order to sell them as slaves in Mexico, they Indians will go around and kidnap young girls and sell them as slaves in Mexico. So what happens is she teams up with her father, played by Tommy Lee Jones, to go track the woman down, and that's the girl down, and that's what the whole story is about, is tracking down these criminals. But the interesting thing is Tommy Lee Jones happened to have abandoned his daughter, his whole family, when they were younger. And went off to live a bad life, but then became a convert to the Indian religion. And so now he's sort of like an Indian convert. He kind of looks like an Indian with long hair and lives like an Indian and believes the Indian religion. But he comes back to try to reconcile with his daughter, but she can't, because she can't forgive him for what he did to her in abandoning her years ago. So their problem is to try to seek the daughter together while they can't stand each other. And, of course, it's working through their redemption with each other. And but the interesting note is that Cate Blanchett plays a Christian in the film. And so it's a comparison and a contrast of the Christian and the pagan religions, in particular the Indian one here. And so it's sort of that interplay between those two. So it's got an interesting religious subtext going throughout. Unfortunately, this film is also very negatively anti-Christian, because what they do is, they show a woman who plays the Christian, and basically her Christianity ends up being of no real effect or power in her life. She's unforgiving to her father. They set her up as being very prejudiced against Indians as savages, so she has this sort of attitude, and she calls them savages and this kind of stuff. And so they set up her as being condescending and prejudiced and bigoted, which, of course, we know that's the concept that most people have of Christians, right? And then there's a comparison of the religions, and basically the Indian religion in this movie really has more power than the Christian religion. The Christian religion doesn't really have power at all, really. It's just sort of a belief. And by the end of the story, the Indian religion has really scored points in a way that humbles and subverts the Christian religion. So, unfortunately, it's a really well-made movie, another 4-star in terms of just an exciting movie. But I couldn't personally recommend it because it's so it's so anti-Christ. And it was sort of discouraging. I didn't expect something like that from Ron Howard, I wouldn't expect him to go out of his way to sort of critique Christianity as being without power. But in this film, that definitely is the case.
Ron Howard, just as a director, of course, has made some of the best films of the last 15 years.
Yeah,
one might argue, and yet it is a little concerning that he is apparently also planning to do a version of The Da Vinci Code again.
Oh,
something
really?
That is deeply
it wouldn't surprise me.
I wonder if he's heading off in a direction now that he's established himself as an extremely talented producer and director. Into kind of getting out a message.
Yeah, boy, that would really be a pattern to me that I did not anticipate. By the way, I wanted to mention that I'm trying to keep. I have a movie blog on my website where I write all my comments on the movies that I watch every week. If people are interested in, and it's free, so you can go there if you're interested in.
Oh, yeah. I'll make sure to mention your website a little bit later here. It is, by the way, folks, Godawa.com, G-O-D-A-W-A.com. Brian Godawa is our guest. It's our holiday movie review. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Gothica. This is the little that I've seen of this features only the face of Halle Berry. What is this film about? The title seems to say nothing.
Yeah, the title doesn't make sense to me other than they wanted to make it sound and sort of create an image of the dark Gothic image, you know. But the story really doesn't seem to have anything to do with Gothic, per se. But basically, Halle Berry plays a psychiatrist who helps mentally insane criminals, particularly women. She counsels them, you know, women who may have, like, in a fit of rage or passion, killed their husband or something like that. And she starts out helping these women, and then what happens is one day on the way home, she has this strange vision of this woman, this girl in the rain. It's just this bizarre, almost ghost-like occurrence, and she doesn't know what it is. Well, it is this crazy, weird experience, and then she wakes up, and all of a sudden she wakes up, and she's in the very insane asylum as a patient where she had previously been treating women. And so, and she doesn't know what has happened in the last 3 days, and she's very confused. And so the movie is about her trying to figure out what happened. And it, you know, it's ultimately sort of revealed that she has killed her own husband, who was also a head of the psychiatric ward. And so the issue comes down to, you know, why did she do this? Now she has had a fit of insane rage, supposedly, and has killed her husband, and why? And in the meantime, she's trying to figure out what really happened while she's being haunted by this spirit of this dead girl. And the dead girl ends up being tied in together with this interesting sort of underground, you know, I won't reveal too much, but it definitely has to do with some evil things that are going on. And so it's sort of a ghost story. And the good thing about ghost stories is modern ghost stories, I think, are a really good moral tool, as they are in this story. And by the way, one of the themes in this story is repression and how repression is a means by which we can survive in the world. Otherwise, we might go crazy. You know, if we repress those bad experiences of the past, it helps us cope with it, you know. But ghost stories are really good because they're really metaphors for the nature of repressed sin. You know, a lot of ghost stories are about ghosts that come back because they're still hanging around. They're still restless because justice has not been served for their murder or for what happened against them. And the story is about working through that justice, and then when the justice is achieved, the ghost then goes away and you never see them again. And very similar to The Others and The Sixth Sense and other ghost stories like that. And that plays a powerful metaphor for the conscience, repressed conscience in man. You know, until sin is dealt with, it like in the book of Genesis, when Cain killed Abel, Abel's blood spoke from the ground to God, so to speak, you know, and I think that's what ghost stories serve, is they're like that blood speaking from the ground for justice until justice is served. That's a very powerful Christian metaphor.
It makes me think not only of some that you have mentioned, Stir of Echoes, The Others, The Sixth Sense, but also of one that was recently out, not a holiday film, but the film Identity.
Yes.
In which exactly the same kind of, and the plot twists are
Brilliant.
It's an amazing Hitchcockian film that deals altogether with sins that have been committed being repressed, and eventually they find their way out.
Yes, yes, and that's for that reason I partially recommend this film. In terms of stars quality, I would say it's rather formulaic and the like, and there's a strong moral problem that I have with the movie. And if you don't mind having the plot twist revealed to you, you could read on the movie blog. But basically, there is a sort of a moral problem that I have with the film. But it's not perfect, but it's good. I'd probably give it like 2 stars or so in terms of quality, somewhat formulaic. But thematically, I would still recommend it because it's a good, strong moral tale.
The Cat in the Hat. One might say, how can you lose with Mike Myers and a proven favorite of boomers everywhere and their children?
Yeah.
Tell us about this film adaptation of Dr. Seuss's fanciful tale.
Yeah, you know, it's basically about these two little brother and sister, and the brother is a slob, and the sister is a neurotic control freak, so they're opposites. So, of course, you're going to have all the humor based on them being opposites of each other. And their mother, who's single and trying to find love in her life. And basically one day the Cat in the Hat magically appears in the house and leads the kids on a fun and exciting, wacky, wild adventure. And, that's basically what it is. You know, I mean, there's a plot to it that's pretty good. And it's, it's basically about the kids learning balance. The sloppy kid has to learn a little bit of responsibility, and the neurotic girl has to learn how to have a little fun. But, unfortunately, I would only somewhat recommend this, and I don't know if I'd recommend it for kids, because unfortunately this is another subversive movie where it's a very clearly a kid film, but they put so much sexual innuendo into it on different levels and bad language and stuff that I don't know that it would be good for kids. And the essence of it is really about this cat brings really chaos and havoc. And, of course, at the end, they're able to still, like, sweep it all under the rug and get away with it. And I'm not sure that that's all that good of an idea to be, kids that need to learn discipline, need to learn responsibility in order to grow up. And this is sort of reinforcing this notion of, hey, let loose, have fun, and have chaos, because it is very chaotic, So, I think that it's sort of more for adults, like a children's story that's more for adults, unfortunately.
It sounds kind of funny to ask this, but... is it true to the book? The book seems to depict the children as not so much participants in the mayhem of the Cat in the Hat, but as they've opened Pandora's box, and they really would like the Cat in the Hat to leave eventually. And he does.
Yeah, there's some of that in there. It's been too long since I've read the books myself, and there is a little bit of that closing of it, but of the need to close that Pandora's box. But I don't get the impression from the movie that he's a negative character in terms of bringing chaos, or that he's a trickster who makes it look like it's fun but it ends in chaos. That's really what it could have been. It could have been a great story if it was more like, hey, let's have fun, and then they see the fun leads to chaos, and then they have to learn to overcome that. But I didn't get that impression from the movie. I may be wrong, but
two final things on this with only a minute to go. Is this a movie, like one of my favorites that's about to come out, being The Return of the King, that is so over-merchandised, by the time you see it, you feel like you've already seen the whole thing?
Yeah, definitely that's the case. And you're pretty much just there for the laughs of Michael Myers,
And then my 7-year-old son doesn't even like watching the commercials for The Cat in the Hat. He thinks the character is scary.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see where he gets that impression. How young is he?
He's 7.
Yeah, okay. Maybe for the real young kids, that might be the case, yeah.
I don't think he has any cat phobias. We got one living in the garage. So, Brian Godawa is our guest. He's a screenwriter in Southern California, a holiday movie review. He's author of the book, Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. He also, as he mentioned before, has a great new movie blog on his website where he reviews the latest from Hollywood. The website is godawa.com, GODAWA.com. When we come back, the film that I have heard nothing bad about, everyone who's seen it says it is an amazing film, you must see it, Master and Commander. Looks great. Looks amazing. We'll see what Brian thinks when we come back. Call us during this break and tell us what you've seen, either on the big screen or on video, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.